Let us turn together now to the Bible, the Word of God, copies of which are sitting in the baskets underneath the seats that you're sitting on. And we're continuing to look together this morning at one of the parables that Jesus tells us in Luke's Gospel. Last week we read the parable of the sower, and this week we're moving on to the parable of the Good Samaritan. Luke chapter 10, beginning at verse 25, it's on page 1041 of the church Bibles. And I'm sure you know Jesus used this technique of telling stories to help people understand really what the kingdom of God is like or what he was talking about. So sometimes he just told them, but sometimes he told them stories. And you know as well as I do that if you watch a film or read a good book or see a play, it maybe just sticks in your mind and you find yourself still thinking about it afterwards. And that perhaps was part of the purpose of what Jesus does here. And of all the stories Jesus told, the Good Samaritan is probably the most famous. There's probably barely a person alive in Scotland today who doesn't know something of this story, even though they've never read the Bible for themselves or may not even connect it all that closely with Jesus. Nevertheless, it's just entered our language and our thinking as being an example of a kind thing to do. The Samaritans is the organization which helps people who are lonely or depressed or in trouble. You phone them up and they will take time with you, and that name, of course, comes from this parable. In our thinking, all Samaritans are good. It's just a word for kindness and helpfulness, although that probably wasn't what the expert in the law to whom Jesus is speaking here would have volunteered if you'd asked him what he thought about Samaritans. But that's the point of the story. So let's read together Luke's Gospel, chapter 10, from verse 25. It tells us, "On one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus." Now, that law, of course, is the Jewish law. So this was a religious leader, a Pharisee, a teacher of the law, someone who made it his job to read and study the Old Testament and apply the rules and regulations to people round about him. "An expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. 'Teacher,' he asked, 'what must I do to inherit eternal life?' 'What is written in the law?' Jesus replied. 'And how do you read it?' He answered, 'Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself.' 'You have answered correctly,' Jesus replied. 'Do this, and you will live.' But he, the expert in the law, wanted to justify himself, so he asked Jesus, 'And who is my neighbor?' And in reply, Jesus said, 'A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he was attacked by robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him, and he went to him and bandaged his wounds and poured on oil and wine. And then he put the man on his own donkey and brought him to an inn and took care of him. And the next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper. 'Look after him,' he said, 'and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have.' Now, which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers?" And the expert in the law replied, "The one who had mercy on him." Jesus told him, "Go and do likewise." Amen. And I trust that God will bless us as we think again about his word. When the earth shakes a country like Nepal to its foundations, as it did just a few days ago and has continued to do with aftershocks since, or when the waves sink the boats of the African refugees fleeing to Europe from Libya, or when the bedroom tax swamps the finances of some of those who are our nearer neighbours, then we are good at giving aid. We set up our food banks, we lobby the government to do something about it, and we give generously to charity. £33 million by yesterday had been collected by the Disasters Emergency Committee to help those in Nepal. So at home and abroad, financially and practically, in disasters, but also on an ongoing, regular, committed basis, we are a charitable people. And you're probably expecting me to come up with a but next and turn that round and say you're not as good as you think you are. But actually, that's not it. I think that's genuinely true, that God, who is generous and kind and loving and supplies our needs, has created us in such a way that we are like him, and we are moved to respond to situations of need. That kind of slightly soppy sigh and goo that came out when I put the baby photo up at the start was a genuine expression of the human heart, that there is someone, a baby, on whom we take pity and would have mercy and would do anything we could to help. God has made us well, and we are a charitable people. Of course, we could do better, that's always the case, but we could do an awful lot worse. And even in this increasingly secular age, when perhaps we're more aware of liberty given to the power of selfishness to look after number one, it seems that our heritage of Christian faith continues to resist at least some of that and connects with that image of God within us and moves us to give. Perhaps because we see someone in trouble and think to ourselves, one day that could be me, there but for the grace of God go I. Perhaps someone will one day need to help me. Or perhaps because we can easily afford it. £33 million is 50 pence a head from our population, so I don't suppose anyone needs to have been impoverished to come up with that sum of money. But perhaps it is genuinely for no other reason than that we care. And as I said, our role model for this could well be taken as the Good Samaritan in our story, who is deliberately portrayed as the kind of extreme of how good you could be if you really did do your best. Here was someone who probably didn't really have time to help. He was on a journey between Jerusalem and Jericho, possibly on business, maybe with a deadline to meet. It clearly wasn't the done thing or fashionable to help, because the first two travelers had just walked on by. It wasn't safe to help, because it was a part of the road where robbers jumped out on people and beat them up and stripped them naked. It wasn't quick or cheap or easy for him to help either. He didn't just dial 999 and pass the problem on to the authorities and go about his business. He had to use the stuff in his bag and the money in his wallet and the time in his diary to get this victim back on his feet again. There was absolutely no prospect of reward, because clearly the stripped and beaten man had nothing to repay him with. And it may not even have been a deserving cause, at least so far as he was aware. We know, because Jesus tells us what happened before the Samaritan came along, we know that this was just a man traveling who got attacked and beaten up. But the Samaritan only found the injured body and doesn't know who started the fight. You know, maybe it was a drug dealer who'd been beaten up by his rivals, or a bully himself who jumped out and tried to rob someone and bitten off more than he could chew. The Samaritan didn't know the back story. He just saw the victim. And yet without hesitation, he forgot about himself and began and completed an act of mercy. And we probably would all be doing better if we could do as well as him. But a good example of kindness is not what this story is about. If we learned and applied that lesson, it would surely do us no harm, but helping people in need that we meet is not the lesson that Jesus is teaching us here. It wasn't a new point that he was making. And you can see that because both of these two men, you will notice, Jesus, the Son of God, and the expert in the law, both of these two men agree that loving God as much as you possibly can and loving your neighbor as much as you love yourself was the good and right and proper thing to do. It was what the law required. Sometimes we think that Jesus invented that clever summary of the law and blew people away with it. Love the Lord your God and love your neighbor as yourself. And folks thought, wow, Jesus, that's a great idea. Why didn't I think of that before? Well, the answer is the teacher of the law, the expert in the law, had thought about that before, and so had loads of others. It was universally agreed by all the Jewish people that helping others was the right thing to do. The dispute here, it's not about whether we should love, but who. Who is my neighbor, in verse 29, whom I should love as myself, is the question the lawyer asks, or the test that he sets. And what's really going on here as this story unfolds, not the story of the Good Samaritan, but the story of Jesus telling the story of the Good Samaritan. What's really going on at the heart of that is three rivalries, three quests for power. The lesson is all about love, but the context is conflict. There's hatred and rivalry in the background here. The first is between Jesus and the expert. An expert in the law, it says in verse 25, stood up to test Jesus, to test Jesus. Not to learn from him, teach me something I didn't know. Not to share with him, let's pool our resources and see what we can come up with, but to catch him out. Because this sophisticated expert trained in the law saw this newbie country bumpkin cousin coming from Nazareth with the sawdust still in his beard and his rough, calloused hands from working at the bench, and thought to himself, any fool can preach that God is love, but if you take it to the next level, if you put it into practice, can he turn a good-sounding principle into a worked-out policy? Can he give people something that will actually work? And the truth is that this expert in the law didn't want to know what the right answer was, because he'd already got that one stitched up and put away. He wanted to show people who the right person was. And by that he meant himself rather than Jesus. A rivalry between the expert and Jesus. And then the second rival at the start of the story is between the priests and the Pharisees. Now, we often think of the priests and the Pharisees together. They kind of trip off our lips like a team, an alliance, because that's often how they appear in the Bible. The priests and the Pharisees got together to plot against Jesus. The priests and the Pharisees went to Pontius Pilate or whatever. We find them united in opposition to Jesus. But actually, that unity between these two groups was, well, I suppose an even more unlikely coalition than some of those that are being talked about in our country today. It just didn't happen. The priests and the Pharisees were bitter rivals because the priests had the temple. They were in charge of formal religion and ritual and festivals and organizing sacrifices. And together with the Levites, who are also mentioned in this story, they're kind of servants or sidekicks, their job was to maintain traditional Jewish worship. Whereas the Pharisees, like this expert in the law, they were the readers, they were the thinkers, they were the actors and the teachers, the radical revisionists who were always wanting to go back to the basics, to get rid of all the encumbrance of tradition and get back to what it was really all about. And they did that by applying themselves to the Word of God. They despised pretentious ritual and routine and studied the Old Testament. And that's why in the Gospels we often find them obsessed with the rules and regulations that are written there, because they wanted to make sure they were always doing the right thing. So it's not that far from Christianity today. You've probably seen that from yourself as I've been describing it, that on the one hand you have the kind of high Anglo-Catholic tradition, and I don't mean to confine that to certain denominations, because all denominations do it, but the high church tradition, which is bells and smells and cathedrals and liturgies and formality and the kind of processions that you see at the coronation or some kind of formal occasion. And on the other hand, there are the kind of down-to-earth, nitty-gritty, practical, evangelical thinkers whose faith is bound up with Bible study and preaching and practice and prayer, who don't want to set themselves apart and be looked up to, but who want to get down and get out and be in amongst it. And here, this teacher of the law, when Jesus began to tell the story, would not have been at all surprised when his rivals, the priests and the Levites, passed the victim by. He would kind of snort and say, well, what else would you expect from the likes of them? They're too holy to be of any earthly use. They wouldn't want to get their hands or their robes dirty. They might look good all dressed up in their finery for a festival and be able to recite the Psalms beautifully, but for all practical purposes, if you want something done, you need a decent Pharisee to come along and save the day. Rivalry between the expert, the teacher in the law, and the priests. And then the third rivalry, of course, that Jesus takes us on to at the end of the story. Well, it wasn't a decent Pharisee who came along and saved the day, but a decent Samaritan. 7 centuries earlier, the Assyrian Empire had deported most of the Jews from the northern part of the country, known as Samaria, because it was round that city, and settled other people there in their place. And some of these immigrants had adopted elements of the Jewish culture of the country they'd moved into, but they were never recognized by the rest of the Jews as natives. And 7 centuries later, that rivalry, that prejudice, that bigotry was still there between the north and the south of the country, between Judea and Samaria, such that I suppose if there had been sporting contests in those days, every Jew would have had 2 teams to support, the nation of Israel and whoever was playing against the Samaritans. And that feeling was mutual. If you look back a chapter, to chapter 9, verse 53, when Jesus was on a journey, it says that the people there in a Samaritan village, that he wanted to pass through or stop in for refreshments, the people there did not welcome Jesus because he was heading for Jerusalem. That meant he was a Jew, they knew who he was, and therefore they didn't want to feed him. And yet in the story, it was in fact a Samaritan who came along last. And as for the victim lying on the ground, well, Jesus never tells us who he is. He might have been a Jew or a Samaritan. He might have been a priest or a Pharisee. He might have been a friend of the expert in the law or somebody he'd never met before. He might even have been the expert in the law himself. This could easily have happened to him. But Jesus doesn't tell us anything in verse 30 except for the fact that it was a man going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, attacked, stripped, and beaten and left. Because the point of the story, obviously, is that we don't need to know who he was. And the Samaritan didn't ask. Because he wasn't thinking about rivalries or prejudice. And so Jesus comes to his conclusion in verse 36. Which of these three, the priest, the Levite, or the Samaritan, do you think was a neighbor to the man? And the expert in the law replies, the one who had mercy on him. So, do you see the change, the movement in the story? The story begins with the expert's question at the start of it, not about whether we should be loving, but who we should love. But Jesus' answer at the end of the story is to say it's not about who we should love, but about whether we are loving. Not the name of the victim lying on the ground, but the nature of the person passing by. Not whether that victim is one of your neighbors, but whether you are one of theirs. And you can see that if you look in the story at what it was that made the Samaritan do it. In verse 33, if you said to him, why did you stop and risk getting robbed by yourself or losing valuable time or spending good money? Why did you do that? And the answer would not be, well, I was doing my religious duty. I was brought up to behave in such and such a way, and I could never have looked my mother in the eye again if I'd walked on by. That wasn't it. Nor is it because he was afraid of God. There might be a judgment to come if I didn't treat other people the way I want God to treat me. Nor is there any kind of sense of trying to gain approval. There will be a spin-off benefit for me in this life or the next, some kind of karma that balances everything out. So if I am a kind person, I will be treated kindly, either by someone else or by Jesus, by God. None of that. When he saw him, it says in verse 30, he took pity on him. In other words, he was filled with pity. He felt it in his heart. And having felt that, if you said to him, why did you stop and pick up the man who was nearly dead? He would say, because I wanted to. My heart was moved. And it would have been painful for me to walk past. I would have gone to bed that night feeling guilty. I would have used the money to buy food for myself, and it would have tasted bitter in my mouth. I did what I want to do. It was a relief to be able to unburden myself of the bursting heart within me that felt compassion for this person. And so the parable takes the word neighbor and redefines it no longer as a question about other people, but as a question about us. And it changes the meaning of the word love as well, because at the start of the story, the focus is on love for God, and he is the one who deserves it. Our heart and our soul and our mind and our strength really ought to be devoted to him, and we should be grateful for the opportunity to do that. But by the end of the story, the word love is defined as mercy. Not what the person receiving it deserves, but what the person who gives it wants to give. So mercy would not just be for the victim of the bedroom tax, but for the merchant banker as well. Mercy is not just for the Christian martyr, but also for the suicide bomber. Mercy is not just for the genuine plight of the homeless Nepalese or the Libyan refugees, but also for the beggars in the streets of our city, whoever they really are, and whatever doubts we might have about who they are working for or what they're going to spend the money on. Because it's not about who or what they are, but who we are, that matters. And of course, the problem with showing mercy is that it's very, very hard to seek what is best for that other person. If the dominating thought of your mind is to show the world that you are a better person than they are. So if rivalry is your motive, then mercy doesn't get a look in. And that's the problem here with the expert in the law, that his real concern is winning all these battles against Samaritans and priests and Jesus. So, who wins the battle and who loses? The big upfront battle between Jesus and the Pharisee. Who wins? Well, look at how it actually pans out. Begins in verse 26 with Jesus asking the expert in the law, what is written in the law? And that's really paying the guy a compliment. You're the lawyer. You tell me. Let me benefit from your learning, from your insight. And when the guy gets the answer right and comes up with the same summary of the law that Jesus himself will use later on, Jesus says in verse 28, you have answered correctly. Well done. And then in verse 37, at the end of the story, because this man who has set himself up as Jesus' rival gets his second question right too, the neighbor is the one who showed mercy, Jesus again says, yes, you've got it right. Go and do likewise. So do you see mercy at work in the telling of the story? No Pharisees were harmed in the making of this film. But one was gently changed. Because Jesus had no enemy to beat, he was free to love his neighbor. He changed his neighbor's mind without ever disagreeing with anything his neighbor said. He was approached by a rival who wanted to destroy him, and he didn't fight back. Not who we should love, but whether we are loving, or maybe whether we are loved. If they were making a film of the Good Samaritan, which part would you want to audition for? Which part do you think you might be suited to or typecast for? Hopefully you wouldn't volunteer to play the part of the Levite or the priest, because as I said at the start, I think we are in general charitable people and we could probably all do better than that. But probably also saw the list at the start and thought, no, maybe I'm not yet ready to play the part of the Samaritan. I like what he did, but I don't think I could keep that up for long. Maybe some of us feel that we are typecast to play the part of the donkey. And what I mean by that is that you feel that other people load their troubles onto your back without asking your permission, and you've no choice but to bear them. Or maybe many of us would feel most at home playing the part of the innkeeper, because he did some taking care of the person who was in need, but he was paid to do it. And that's sometimes our society's solution by how much would we need to raise taxes in order to be a caring generation. But I guess the reality is probably this, that the part we're best equipped to play is the part of the victim lying on the ground, because all of us have to have a journey through life, not just from Jerusalem to Jericho, that is sometimes dangerous. It's dangerous, but there is no safe alternative. There's not enough cotton wool in the world to keep us wrapped up in all the time. So we've all been out there and been assaulted, not perhaps physically by robbers, all of us, but been assaulted and bullied and robbed of our innocence. We tried to do the right thing and someone took advantage of us, of our openness. I'm not going to get caught out like that again. I'm going to protect my heart from the emotions it sometimes tries to feel. robbed of our faith because we believed in someone or maybe even in God, and he didn't treat us the way that we expected, robbed of our hope. Sometimes even if we're Christians, it's without any hope that it's really going to get much better. And sometimes it does seem that even our pity, that welling up inside us of compassion for others, even that has been taken away, and we see the news with the bad things that happen, and we just kind of groan and want to move on because we can't make a difference. So we're there, we're badly beaten, we're deeply scarred, and there's no way that we can help ourselves. There's no prospect of making any kind of recovery because the beatings are going to continue. And all we can do is get worse. And if that is us, if that's the part we are playing, we certainly don't want the priest or the Levite coming along with their self-righteous platitudes, pretending consolation. And probably even the Samaritan, when we first see him, we are dubious about because we wonder in what way he is going to exploit us. But maybe the good thing in the story, if that is the part we play, is that the Samaritan didn't ask the victim on the ground if he wanted to be helped, because the victim was unconscious and very nearly dead. And helplessness cannot resist mercy. So if that really is us, if we really are the wounded victim, and if there really was someone who maybe didn't have to come to our rescue, who isn't paid to come and cannot be repaid, and yet isn't afraid to stop and to stay, and to give and to spend, and to carry us along with him and to lay us down and then to return, then perhaps after all we can be saved. And of course the answer is that there is such a one, and that his name is Jesus. That God's law, that you love God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength and love your neighbor as yourself in the way that the parable describes, God's law describes what God has done, because Jesus is God and God is love. And so this whole story, the gospel story, the Christmas story, is about Jesus becoming our neighbor. Easter, if you like, is him pouring out what he had for us, not the oil and wine in his bag or his clothes ripped up into our bandages, but his blood poured out to save us. And maybe in a sense, resurrection is his return to follow the thing through, to make sure that we're all right. And if that is the case, then the part of being the victim is a safe part to play, because the real good Samaritan is Jesus. And if that is the truth, then the only real danger is this: that like the expert in the law, we make Jesus our rival. Not just that we try to make other people our rivals and doing better or being better or talking better than them to show that we are more accomplished and deserving is our number one motivation. Not just that we see our faith as better than other people's, and because we don't parade around in robes, or because we do, our religion is guaranteed to gain God's approval. But the danger that we see ourselves as better than Jesus, and when he comes along, at the very least, our job is to put him to the test, to try and catch him out. And even if we in the end are grudgingly forced to admit that he passes the test, if he's our rival, you can still be sure of this, that we're never going to ask him for help. And so there is the victim, helpless and bitter and bleeding and naked and dying. But what if he wasn't quite unconscious and pride was the last thing to die? Then the victim's last words with his dying breath when the Samaritan knelt down beside to offer help would be to say, "No, thank you. Because I can take care of myself." And if that is the final word, then no Samaritan and no neighbor and not even Jesus can do anything about it. And I pray that God will follow with his blessing, the reading and the teaching of his word.